It's Wednesday, February 28th, 2024, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the studio in the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, coverage of the Chiefs celebration parade from 2 weeks ago and why journalists are not naming the juveniles charged in the incident. A new survey shows Missouri is the 17th best state to be a journalist. We'll take a look at how researchers arrived at that. And oral arguments in a long-awaited Supreme Court case, two of them actually questioning freedom of speech on social media. But we're going to start with a different, not so exciting, disruption in the digital journalism space. Another round of job cuts at BuzzFeed and the complete shutdown of both Vice and Deceased, most recently being housed at WAMU in Washington. Kathy, there were 15 people who were let go at WAMU, just about all of them associated with the Deceased product. Remind us, how did that hyperlocal digital outlet end up in public radio space to begin with?
Well, it's part of a trend, actually, that I would say was started right here in Missouri when the public radio station, our sister station in St. Louis, took on the St. Louis Beacon, right? And so you've been seeing since that a number of these hyperlocal publications, and in the case of Chicago, not so hyperlocal, combining with public radio.
Meaning WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times.
Exactly.
Okay, go ahead. Just to clarify that.
Yes, exactly. And so what was striking about the situation in D.C., which, full disclosure, I know some of those people, and so it's very sad for me, but it seemed counter to the trend because there's a really interesting piece about the WBEZ Chicago Sun-Times merger, a podcast on Editor and Publisher, where the talk is about the advantage to both of these organizations, because public radio tends to have an audience that's older, wealthier, and in the case of the Sun-Times, it's a gritty city publication. So it's a combination of audiences, and they can actually help each other. And the same thing with DCist and some of these other online startups. They tend to have audiences that are younger, more hip, and in other words, a good play for the public radio. So I was surprised by this and disappointed, frankly. And also, last week I was at the Knight Media Forum, and, you know, 24 foundations have come together to put together a fund of over $600 million to try to pump local news up. And so it would seem to me operations like this would be great candidates for this kind of money. So it just seemed really premature and harsh.
Well, I mean, I think this goes back to the disruption that we've seen across media, especially in the last year. And I think it's a combination of the changing landscape of where people get their news and information. I also think it's the coming out of the pandemic shutdown and a lot of changes that have occurred within the economy. We start talking about inflation and other things. But I also think that it's a...
And COVID just killed some of these local startups.
Absolutely. Yeah. It killed a lot of these local startups. And it also led to many of the traditional news media that were leaning into those areas beginning to pull back because they haven't seen what they would consider to be a return on investment for what they put into it. And I think that's a huge part of it. But the other thing I think is people are making choices about where they're going to get their news and information, where they're going to get their entertainment. We've talked about that, I mean, with all the streaming services and everything. To me, I think what's happening is that people are saying, look, this is what I'm going to pay for and this is what I'm not going to pay for. And they've made those choices. And to a certain extent, especially when you start looking at the whole landscape of both NPR as well as the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, that philanthropic type of revenue coming in has somewhat dwindled for them. They're hoping to get it back, but I don't know what that's going to look like.
Yeah, I think the painful thing here, and you know, I think the vice shutdown is really part of what you're talking about. That you know, there were a lot of people who made big bets and spent a lot of money, frankly.
And right. That's what happened with Vice, not hyperlocal.
Well, it also happened with BuzzFeed as well.
Right. And so Vice, go ahead, as you were going to say, they shut down.
So I think that's part of yes, too. And I think that's part of the larger landscape you're talking about. Very saturated with all these startups. Not everybody's going to make it. The disappointing thing to me about DCist and seeing a big merger like that kind of fall apart is that I think it takes time. I think what I was hearing at the Knight Media Forum last week, people are now understanding that philanthropy has to be a revenue stream.
Right.
It isn't just one and done. There has to be a revenue stream involved, and subscriptions, and the donor model that we have here at KBIA is a very important part of that. But that takes time to build up. And it was just disappointing to me that they didn't, and with all this money out there waiting, you know, that they didn't or couldn't for whatever reason say, let's hold on for another year, let's apply for some grants, let's try to think of a way to make this work.
One of the things is you talk about Vice ceasing its digital operations. That was another one of those very highly innovative sites that pushed a lot of boundaries. And what's happened there is actually being called by many a failure of the leadership in that environment, especially when it came to spending, that perhaps the spending was not directed in some of the best places, that wasn't as much about a struggle to survive as it was about some questionable decisions that led to a drain on resources.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of those where, you know, Vice tried to have, at least from what you could see across the time that it was there, we wanted to have a big story every quarter. And we're going to spend as much money as it takes to have that big story every quarter, because if you're doing that four times a year, one of those stories is going to hit and win a big award.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that is it's not sustainable over a longer period of time. I mean, it kind of goes back to what you're talking about. What's going to be the long-term revenue there? And how are you going to manage those funds over the course of the long term? And how are you going to be innovative in what it is that you're doing? I mean, one of the things that, I mean, Vice was doing some really good stories, but the stories started to look the same. And they were investigated the same. And sometimes you need variety, mm-hmm, in order to be able to keep people coming back and looking for something, because they're going to find those kinds, yeah, of stories someplace else.
I think that's exactly what local news does. You know, if you're looking at a local news site, once in a while you are going to have a big story that's a big scandal and blow the lid off the town. But most of the time it's, how did the kids' high school football team do? What's the city council doing? And that's where I think Washington, for all the media that exists there, is a news desert when it comes to local news. I mean, I know, because it was a major research project for me when I was trying to figure out how to vote in the municipal races. Nobody covers that stuff. So that's where the opportunity is. And I think there was a great quote that somebody said at the Knight Media Forum. If you work for Main Street instead of Wall Street, you make decisions differently.
Right. Hmm. Right.
Well, so when the Vice staffers were let go, they went to go and capture some of their clips, evidence of the stories that they had worked on, pieces that would fill out a portfolio as they looked for other employment. Only the site was wiped. Their work was gone. And I guess a part of me kind of gets it. Hosting a website long term is an expense, right? Keeping that content out there, especially if the business itself isn't viable anymore. But this brings us right back to that concept of the internet being a memory hole, whereas journalists were publishing work. This has all just been unpublished. That archive doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, I mean, this is a huge problem. And the same thing happened with the DCS site, by the way. And I will say one thing. You know, yes, it's an expense to maintain a website, but they're just like renting a room in the National Press Building. Your lease runs till the end of the month. So why they had to, I mean, once they announced they were doing this, why they didn't give the journalists a grace period to pull down some of that material, I do not understand. But it really does get to the importance of something that we talk about at the J School with our students, and that is journalists have to keep their own archives and figure out a way to do that, because these kind of things happen. There are people who are starting to think about archiving and how outside libraries and the Internet Archive is a famous one. But no one's really doing a systematic job of that, as far as I know.
Well, I think this is where business decisions are made without thinking about what is the long-term historical value to some of this work. I mean, because there are digital archives out there. There are organizations out there that will take that information and preserve it. But you have these organizations like Vice and others who are making decisions based on the bottom line of and what that looks like right there in the moment, as opposed to saying, okay, fine, we're going to cease publication mm-hmm. using an old term. We're going to cease publication, but they're not thinking about, okay, we're going to hand this over to a library, or we're going to find a digital opera. Sort of like what you were saying. I mean, you don't have to shut that down and wipe all of that out right away. You can wait to see what value does that have outside of the monetary value.
It's kind of ironic if you think about it, right? Because as journalists, we think of ourselves as the people who are creating the first drafts of history. And in doing this, wiping it out entirely. Anybody who go ahead.
I was going to say, you're talking about it in terms of the way journalists think. Yeah. The people who actually own those operations, the hedge funds and the financiers, they're not thinking about that. They're thinking about, okay, we've just shut this down. We're trying to minimize any kind of public relations damage that could happen, or somebody coming into that website and maybe taking some information and using that information for their own financial purposes or whatever. And so we're going to just basically shut the whole thing down. That way we're going to sort of protect ourselves. And so whereas the journalists are going, whoa, 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 wait a minute. You know, I spent a lot of time on that. That's actually intellectual capital for me. Can I please have that? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's where the problem comes in.
And, you know, I'm going to throw one of the Ernest-isms back at you, though. It's not about the journalist entirely. I think about the greater good. I think of some of that work that Vice did do, maybe how it peeled the curtain back a little bit on North Korea in some of its early reporting. That could all be gone now.
Well, that's true.
And you know, from a historical standpoint, when that's gone, that's gone.
When that's gone, that's gone. And I mean, you're right. It's the greater good. But oftentimes, business doesn't wait or even consider the greater
good.
And
that's the big problem. Yeah. Too many hedge funds are owning these organizations and not enough. I think it's the Wall Street, Main Street
argument right there. So yesterday, as I was putting together today's show, I got an email, totally coincidentally, from an organization called PR Prism, and it was promoting a new survey it conducted that showed Missouri is the 17th best state in the union to be a journalist. On the surface of it, I was a bit skeptical, thinking about some of the things we've talked about on this show, and looked at the methodology, and it started to make a little bit more sense, because they were looking at things like the pay that journalists get and comparing that to the cost of living and the number of physical attacks on journalists while on the job. Now, mind you, in Missouri, in the time they were studying, there were no fatal attacks on journalists. So apparently that ranked us rather high. Would you have expected it to be 17?
Well, based on the methodology
makes sense.
Based on the methodology, yes. But, you know, when you stop and think about it, okay, the salaries as opposed to the cost. But then you also have to think about, which I didn't see in there, the number of media outlets within Missouri has a huge bearing on where you're going to fall on that scale. Mm-hmm. And there are not as many media outlets in Missouri as, say, you know, a larger state like Texas or Florida or Virginia, for that matter.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that has an impact on how the states are ranked.
Yes.
Yeah, I think the key fact is what Ernest identified. There's thousands. I mean, there's some incredible percentage. I'm going to get it wrong, but it's a more than 50% of journalists live in five cities in the United States. And they're largely on the coast except for Chicago. And so that, to me, is the real problem. The real problem is we don't have enough boots on the ground in the vast swaths of the country, and we need them, and that's why we need to come up with a different revenue model.
Right.
One of the other things that it didn't necessarily take into account as I was looking at the rankings, because I was kind of surprised to see, especially given some of the things we've talked about in the last few months, that the top state, the best place to be a journalist in the U.S. is just to our west in Kansas. Which is interesting because we have been
You live in Marion.
Right. We've spent a lot of time talking in the last 5 months. And in fact, there was even a story I came upon this week talking about how the chilling effect in Marion County, where there was the raid on the local newspaper, it is still in place there. Smack dab in the middle of that ranking is Iowa. The data from that state shows that there were 10 noted violations of press freedoms. And while I can't guarantee what has been going on with journalist Laura Beelen is one of them, we can't overlook the fact that until very, very recently, she had been denied access to that state's legislature for 5 years. Now, for 30 years, she's been a bylined journalist in Iowa. Why was the House so reluctant to give her a seat on press row?
Well, you know, this looks like a very political problem. We had the same problem here when the Missouri Independent first started, and the governor didn't want to recognize them because of their funding sources. And I think as it does create a real problem as you have this plethora of new startups. There are always rules about covering legislatures and who gets those credentials, and they're valuable, and there should be rules because you don't want lobbyists coming in and saying, oh, I have a newsletter, therefore I'm a journalist, so I get to sit at this front row seat. You want people who are actually doing stories for the general public, for the greater good, as you said, Amy. But the way that should be done, in my opinion, is the way it's done in the United States Congress, which is there is a committee, elected committee of journalists who review the credentials and make the decisions. Now, everybody has to pass a security test or, you know, a security check that the police do. I mean, obviously, professional law enforcement officials. But it's the journalists who are looking at these publications and saying, yes, this is a legitimate publication. No, it's not. And that, I think, is, and Congress did that deliberately because they didn't want to be seen as making a decision on who could cover them. And I think it was a very smart decision. Now, they made it back in the 1800s. I don't know if they'd make the same decision today, but what's done is done. And I think it's a fantastic model for other people to follow.
Well, I mean, it's a model. Let's just say that. Okay. Because there has...
You got a better one?
I don't have a problem with the model. I do have a problem with the makeup, and I've always had a problem with the makeup because I've studied this as a historian, and oftentimes that makeup is made up of generally white men.
The usual suspects.
And the usual suspects. Yeah. And quite often, if you go back and look in history, there have been publications that have been left out of that realm, in particular publications that served people of color. You've had women who have been left off of that and have not gotten access. And so there are issues with not so much the model, but how the model
operates.
The status quo. Exactly, the status quoism.
Going now, back to that 1800s.
Perhaps
the model hasn't been adapted.
Right. But in this instance, I mean, I think that it this is more political than anything else in keeping her from being able basically to do her job. And you're seeing more and more of that depending on which party is in power at the time and how they feel about the press. And I think that even if it's someone from a legacy media outlet, if that legacy media outlet is not in the favor of that party, then they're going to be facing the same kind of pushback.
And I think this is exactly what prompted Congress to create that model back in the 1800s. And I agree that there is a problem of status quoism. That is a problem. But still, having journalists make the decision is better, especially if, you know, journalists tend to hold each other's feet to the fire.
Right, right.
But I think, given what you're talking about, back in the early days of this country, journalists were very much attached to political parties.
Absolutely.
And so that was a way of getting around that. So we're going back to those days now, it looks like. And so how do we cope with this? And especially with all these new startups, do we really want political hacks evaluating whether they – I don't want people deciding – I don't want the government deciding who gets to cover it.
Right.
Okay, so yesterday, speaking of that, yesterday, Georgia-based Cox Enterprises announced that it bought a majority stake in OpenGov. It's a software company that helps local and state governments modernize the technology that it uses to improve transparency. So among the services that OpenGov provides, we've got typical operational stuff like budgeting, accounting, and asset management. But it also builds portals for the publishing of government data and the fulfillment of public records requests. So it's an interesting business for a newspaper company to get into, for sure. That idea of helping to fulfill records requests, perhaps that they would even be making.
Yeah, it's kind of dicey.
I disagree. I think it's really smart, but go ahead.
It's kind of dicey because to me, it's one of those things where if you're filling an open records request for a governmental entity, and what if the governmental entity says, no, we're not going to do that, but then you're also engaged with the journalism organization on the other side saying,
but hey, we own the software that makes it really easy for you to do that. So
right.
don't tell
that,
me it's too hard.
And that's the part that I think is helpful to journalism is the fact that they're basically saying, hey, we can make this easier for you to be able to do this and fulfill the law. Mm-hmm. Not outside of the fact that you probably don't want this information out there because it's going to make you look bad or this, that, or the other.
Yeah.
You know, so in that regard, I think it is good. But then that's where I kind of go like, oh, wait a minute, there could be some problems here.
Well, I just think it's way overdue. I mean, I think this is a revenue stream for journalism.
Well, I agree with that.
We take, because we're working with government data all the time, and our specialty is making it accessible to the public and making it understandable to the public. So I think being able to take some of these records and, you know, for instance, I would love to take over, have the Missouri School of Journalism take over the Missouri Ethics Commission, which has the worst website for looking things up, and put some journalism sauce on it, you know, and say, this is what we really need to know. This is what the public really needs to know from campaign finance records or lobbying disclosures. It's a very clunky website. And I think if you have journalists involved who know what the public needs to know, it's great. So it's great for journalism, but it's also great because it's a natural revenue stream. It's work we do anyway, and if you can repurpose it, there are going to be lobbying firms who want that information. There are going to be businesses that want that information. You can create a revenue stream to support journalism. Bravo.
No, I agree with everything you just said.
And
who owns?
The public. The public owns those records, and
I agree with you. I agree with you that the public owns the information, but more often than not, the politicians are the ones who are making the decisions as to who actually has access to it, and they would claim that we work for the public because they elected us. You all are not elected officials. I mean, I just see that argument coming out.
Well,
you know?
It'll be an interesting argument, but I think
I'm not taking any sides on this, by the way.
I think it's a really smart business play.
I agree with that.
I think it may have some legal. There may be, but this is happening anyway. There are these companies that are going in to cities and saying, let us run your website. It's a very complicated thing. Mm-hmm. We'll do it. But then they own the data. And what if the city decides we want to move to a different vendor?
That's true.
So it is a problem that's out there already. And this is something we need to go through. But I'd rather have journalists have the data because we know what to do with it.
Okay. So before we go, you may have noticed that we weren't on last week, so we didn't get to talk too much about the coverage of the Chiefs celebration parade and the shooting that happened there. In fact, our show 2 weeks ago was recorded before the shooting took place, so we elected not to air it on KBIA during its regular 6:30 time slot. Here we are 2 weeks later, and there are still questions about how the news media is covering the story. Some of that criticism is coming from Kyle Rittenhouse. You may remember him. He is the man from suburban Chicago who shot and killed three men during protests in Kenosha, Wisconsin in August 2020. At that time, he was 17 years old, and his name and identity were released upon charges being filed because he was charged as an adult. Still, Rittenhouse posted on X, formerly known as Twitter, that he wanted to know the names of the teens that were charged in connection with the incident and wanted to know why they hadn't been named. And the answer to his question is pretty simple. It has nothing to do with race, as he was insinuating. What was the reason that they haven't been named?
Well, the reason they haven't been named is because under Missouri law, they're not being charged as an adult, so their names are not going to be released, and they weren't charged with felonies, even in juvenile court. So that's another reason why.
Okay. I mean, we are talking about this to correct the record, so that the audience understands.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Okay, cool. I mean, that's another reason why the names have not been released, and that doesn't mean that there's probably some media out there who know the names of these individuals, but they've chosen not to release that because it is still under investigation, and they're not even sure what those charges are going to be, even in juvenile court, and whether or not they're actually going to stick. So I think that has a lot to do with that as well.
Kathy, talk for a minute about the ethics of naming a juvenile, even if you do know the juvenile's name in a case like this.
Well, and I think some of our colleagues from Mizzou here were quoted on the Poynter Institute with some really good points. And one of those points is that people do stupid things when they're young, and do we want that to follow somebody? We don't know what the circumstances were here. Who pulled the trigger? The Kate has.
Or whether or not they pulled the trigger at all. They may have just been carrying a weapon there.
Exactly. Yeah. And with older people. So we don't know the circumstances. And I think before you go putting somebody's name in the paper that in a way that's going to be reputationally damaging, you stop a beat if you're a responsible journalist. And that's what I think is going on here. And this is the law in Missouri, as Ernest pointed out. But I think minors are not the same as grown adults. They don't often have the same volition. We don't know why these kids were there. So I just think caution is better.
Yeah.
Okay. If you do want to take a look at that, the piece from Poynter is on our Links blog. It has information from our colleague Kelly Stanfield and also from one of our campus colleagues, Clark Peters. We are out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today and about those Supreme Court cases that we didn't get a chance to talk about. That's under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to the program again, leave comments, questions, see what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, to Kia Thomas for handling the audio, Tim Pilcher composed our theme music, and Nate Brown is our social media manager.